My name is Caroline Duncan, and I'm a student in the Veterans Oral History Program, a joint project between the University of Victoria and the Royal United Services Institute of Vancouver Island. Today is Thursday, November 19th, 2009, and I'm speaking to Major General Herb Pitts at his home in Victoria. General Pitts, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
It's a pleasure, Caroline, and I look forward to a discussion with you.
2010 marks the 150th anniversary of the Queen's Own Rifles. Could you tell me about the history of the regiment and your involvement with it?
Yes, I can certainly give you an outline. I don't profess to know it in great detail, but I've been associated with it since 1954. I returned from Korea and was among a number of young officers in that time period who were spread among regiments that were just forming in the regular force. And the Queen's Own had a long history in the reserves or militia, but were tasked to provide two battalions for early service in the NATO commitment in Europe in the early 50s. And while they didn't get to Korea during the active phase of that war, the second battalion of that regiment was there during the truce supervisory period from 1954 to 55, at which time they returned to Victoria and were stationed here from 55 to 57 in what is now the University of Victoria. The barracks was known as Gordon Head. And it was the last major unit to serve in Gordon Head, or what is now UVic, when they left in 1957 to go to NATO service in Germany. They turned over the keys to the University of Victoria stewards at that time, and the land was ceded by the federal government to the university. And the man who turned over the keys at that time is now Lieutenant Colonel John Dirksen, who lives here and is still reasonably active, and we're hoping will take place in the dedication of a cairn at UVic next summer, next April, which will mark the 150th anniversary of the regiment. As I said, the regiment, well, let me complete the other story about service here in Victoria and why we're doing commemorative events here. The 1st Battalion returned from NATO service in Europe in the fall of 1963 and was stationed at Work Point Barracks for a period of 7 years, from 63 to 70, at which time that battalion overnight was changed from 1st Battalion, the Queen's Own Rifles, to 3rd Battalion, Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry. It was one of those reorganization things that took place in the late 60s and early 70s when the Army was cut back to a certain extent, and the amalgamations or conversions of units were taking place. The Black Watch was converted mainly to the Royal Canadian Regiment. The Guards were virtually disbanded, and the Queen's Own, luckily, had the opportunity to convert as a whole unit to the Patricias. And a number of them from the 2nd Battalion, who were not reinforcements to our 1st Battalion before the conversion, ended up going and being the founding members of the Canadian Airborne Regiment, which was stationed in Edmonton. Now, that's the recent history, in that it spans sort of the 50s and the 60s and into the 70s. The regiment itself was formed in 1860 and will mark its 150th anniversary next April. That will be marked by events both. It'll be marked by events here in Victoria, in Calgary, and then in Toronto. There's a sequence of events taking place within 1 week, at which time our Colonel-in-Chief, who is Princess Alexandra, the cousin to the Queen, will be with us. At the same time the regiment is marking its 150th anniversary, Alexandra is marking her 50th anniversary as our Colonel-in-Chief. She will be stepping down after the festivities or events of 2010, but her connection with us will be maintained in many ways. One through the establishment of an educational bursary in her name, which will be available to principally the descendants of serving and retired members of the regiment. Some openings will be available for public bidding. Precedence, however, will be given to a direct regimental connection. So we'll have three or four bursaries a year to hand out across the country to commemorate her service to the regiment and the regiment's service to Canada. It's a long and distinguished history. It started with the repulsing of the Fenian raiders from the northern United States in 1866. Went through the Northwest Rebellion in the 70s, 80s, appeared again as a big component of the Boer War contingent, where a battalion was always stationed in Europe in the First World War, and it commemorates three or four Toronto area battalions who were amalgamated into the Queen's Own. It was a time when battalions or regiments didn't bear their more familiar names, like the Queen's Own Rifles of Canada, but numbered battalions. And the 3rd Toronto Battalion was the one that was composed mostly of Queen's Own Riflemen. The Second World War saw the regiment participate in the first landings in continental Europe. There, they were an assault battalion on the D-Day landings and were the only unit, apparently, which managed to go inland far enough to capture its D-Day objectives. There may have been others, but it's a matter of regimental pride that we did it. And the cost was considerable, but their job was accomplished. And they participated throughout that campaign through France and were renowned for the participation in the liberation of Holland, a connection which we'll talk about a little later, but they were involved in that. The Queen's Own today have members of their battalion serving in Afghanistan. There are probably 50 or 60 riflemen who, over the pure course of that war, have participated in the Afghan campaign. I attended a dinner for some of them the other night, and there were 36 people at the dinner, six outsiders like myself who were not veterans of the Afghan campaign, but there were 30 participants there from the regiment that were available to attend. And it was a mixture of old veterans and new veterans, so to speak. There was a veteran from the Second World War, a veteran from the First World War, a parachute battalion veteran, and myself representing the Korean War. So it was kind of nice to get together with young people who are motivated in much the same way as we were years ago and who are carrying forward the name of the regiment as participating in the current campaign. One of the members of the regiment was awarded the Medal of Bravery for having pulled explosives out of a burning carrier before it really wrecked the marketplace, which is where it was stopped by a propelled grenade, which disabled the vehicle and set it on fire. But the Bravery Act was going into this burning vehicle and pulling ammunition and explosives out of there before any real damage was done to the community. That young man was present and is regarded as a hero among the regimental people who know what he's done. And, of course, there are 300 serving in the regiment now in the militia, and they're all aware of this man's accomplishments. So the unit has a long and proud history of participation in Canadian military affairs. There have been some remarkably successful people in terms of achieving high rank, and I won't go into those, but if there was interest in time, we could discuss that in another interview. But that, in a nutshell, is the history of the regiment, and one in which we're very proud and want to mark next April.
And tell me about the ceremony and the cairn planned for next April.
In town here, we've got Princess Alexandra, whose colonelcy we share with the Canadian Scottish. So we can't bring her to town or bring her to Victoria and keep her all to ourselves. The Canadian Scottish are going to help us in some ways in welcoming her, but not in the participation of the two cairns that we're marking. We're going to have her unveil a cairn at Work Point Barracks. The Navy has been very cooperative, now being the owner of what was formerly and to many known as an Army barracks. But they're supporting us, and we will be having her unveil a cairn there on the first day of her visit. She will then go from there to the Canadian Scottish to a reception, and then she'll rejoin the Queen's Own for a large dinner event at the Saanich Recreation Center Gymnasium. We expect between 350 and 400 people will be dining with her that night. That same afternoon, while she is at the Scottish reception, our honorary colonel, who is a businessman from Calgary named Paul Hughes, will unveil a second monument at the University of Victoria. That marker will contain the sentence that it's being done on the occasion of the visit of Princess Alexandra to Victoria on the 150th anniversary. But unfortunately, she is limited in how many she will be able to do. And the one day that was planned for her being in Victoria was full of events. And so we couldn't get her to commit to unveiling both of them as much as we'd have liked it. But it will be suitably unveiled by the University of Victoria, who I might say is really participating in a very generous manner with us to make sure that works. We've got a very good planning committee operating in the Victoria event, in the University of Victoria event.
Where at the university will it be located?
If you know the university at all, there's a bus loop there, and associated with that bus loop and adjacent to it, there is a parking lot, but there is also a green space which has got two white pillars, which in fact were the old entrance to Gordon Head Barracks. And those two white pillars have placed within it a monument which has been there, I guess, from late 50s, early 60s, commemorating the fact that this was once an Army base. It was once a radio station, military radio station. And it signifies on that current monument that the 2nd Battalion of the Queen's Own Rifles was the last unit to be stationed there. As mentioned, they turned the keys over to UVic on departure for Germany. So it will be located not far from that bus loop and parking area. So it is relatively obvious when you come in. Now it's going to have new whitewash on the gatepost, and it'll have the new paint job on the monument itself where this present plaque is placed. There'll be a new plaque placed on that same wall, which will commemorate the occasion next spring. So it's in a fairly public and obvious place. A lot of people don't know where it is, and I didn't until I went looking for it. So there are remnants of the old barracks still within the complex of the UVic. The huts are recognized as being kind of a standard Army issue, if I can put it that way. And I'm not sure what use is being made of them now, but they are close to this site as well. So that's kind of the story of what will happen here. Unknowns to us in the first correspondence about this visit to Victoria was the fact that she has decided now to have a rest day. And it appears that rest day may be spent in Victoria. I can't confirm that. We're trying to get it confirmed at the moment. Which would mean that she'll have a little more time in Victoria than was originally planned. And it may be that even if she doesn't unveil it, we may get her on her rest day up to take a look at it anyway and see what's been done in her name. The rest day is going to be spent, and then she goes on to Calgary. And there are similar events going to take place there. And then the big event is in Toronto, and that is a self-funding event by the regiment as well. There is no government support, that is federal government support or provincial support, in any of the events that I've discussed. These are all self-funded by the regiment and by the local branches of the association. So this commemoration is, in a quote, in a way, I guess, private. But she will be staying at Government House. And so, in a sense, we're receiving some support.
Is it deliberate that you're not asking for government funding for the events or for the monument itself?
It is deliberate in that our chances, based on past experience, of getting much support are pretty slim. Also, the economy being what it is at this juncture made us hesitant to approach anybody for support, except fundraising on our part. And our national association is connected with our own Queen's Own Rifles of Canada Trust, who does have some money accumulated over the years to support some of these activities. Mind you, if it's gone to support these activities, it won't be available to support others for a while. But this is considered of such importance that it has to be properly financed. And the regiment is doing it almost entirely on its own. The Canadian Scottish will be providing assistance in the form of transport and baggage party and perhaps pipers and drummers, which will complement the pipers, drummers, and skirmishers coming from Toronto in our uniforms, so that they will be there to dress up the areas of the monuments. And the Queen's Own has a very characteristic series of bugle calls, which they use for calling people to dinner and that sort of thing, but also they provide a harmonious a combination of a drummer and four buglers for the last post and reveille, in which people are familiar with it, but the call is basically harmonized by the four buglers. We won't have four buglers here, we'll have two, but there will be a melodic sort of accompaniment to the drummer sounding and the two buglers presenting the call. We will use the pioneers and skirmishers for either side of monuments and for looking like they always do, reflective of the history of the regiment, in that they'll be wearing period uniforms. So that's an outline of what we're doing now.
And in terms of the cairn, who will be responsible for the preservation of the cairn? Will it be UVic?
Well, one is being placed within DND. The other is being placed within the University of Victoria. Should there be any question about money needed to look after refurbishment, that could probably be supplied by the regiment. What did happen and what was committed from early times was Naden's support to put the foundation of this cairn in. It is about 4 feet square and quite deep and settled well, so that there is a smooth concrete surface slightly raised above the grass on which to place the stone. The stone we're placing there has got time capsule slots in the bottom, so we'll be placing a couple of time capsules in there containing various regimental items, orders, paraphernalia, pictures. Not that they would be opened at any particular time, but they will be there for future. And the placement of that monument and the carving of it is entirely regimental responsibility, so we'll fund that. But DND has given us support in the form of construction, if you will.
And speaking of preservation of monuments, can you tell me about the monument in Holland? and okay. Preservation by
Children.
Yeah,
we briefly mentioned that when we were discussing the interview. There is a fellow who lives in Nanaimo who was returned to his home village called Doorn in Holland this past summer.
And that's D-O-O-R-E-N?
No, D-O-O-R-N.
R-N,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, Doorn, I guess. Maybe a better pronunciation. But Doorn is his birthplace, and he was an 11-year-old boy when that village was liberated by the Queen's Own Rifles. He distinctly remembers the badges and the numbers on the carriers, which rolled into town as part of the advance party, and the fact that they were riflemen who entered the town. He's immigrated to Canada in his early or mid-20s and settled in a number of places, but now lives in Nanaimo. And because of his service in the Dutch Army after the war, he joined the Nanaimo branch of the Legion. So happened, the president of the Nanaimo branch was a rifleman, retired. And in any event, his name is Hovestad. Hovestad relayed the story that while on a visit last summer to his village, he noticed that a monument area was littered with some leaves and pine cones, and it didn't look like it had been cleaned, sort of brushed and scraped and that sort of thing, for a while. So he wrote the local the mayor and said, I think it's disgraceful that this country doesn't look after in a tidier way the monument dedicated to our liberators. Now, the monument is two parts. One is a column which is dedicated to liberation generally, and in front of that column there is a flat plaque with the Queen's Own regimental crest in it. It was around this plaque, I guess, that some of the pine cones and things had gathered, and that's the basis of his complaint to the mayor. The mayor didn't respond, so the next step was to write the newspaper, which he did. And, of course, this was news, in that a Dutch naturalized Canadian now returned home to find the monument or the plaque to the liberators not being cared for. The Dutch, being the kind of people they are, read this story, and there were a number of responses to him as a result of the story, but one of them is of particular interest. It so happens that a father read the story, I guess told his teenage son about it. Actually, he wasn't a teenager. He was 10 at the time, last summer. And the son said, well, yeah, that's kind of bad. Is there something we can do? And the father said, well, you could get a few of your friends, I guess, and go look after it. Or the son said, and I'm not sure which is the correct version, I can get some friends and look after it. And the father then contacted Hovestad, who accepted the offer for maintenance or cleaning of the area. And it was arranged that once a month, this boy and some of his friends would come along and clean the area, despite the fact that the city hadn't replied. Well, when the story hit the press, the city did reply, and at that point they offered to provide the group of youngsters with cleaning materials and brushes and supervision and whatever was necessary. That group of youngsters, ranging from 10 to I think 12, have called themselves the A-Team. Now, I don't know what A stands for in Dutch, but presumably it may be a takeoff on the A-Team of television series too. And when the news of their willingness to look after the wall got back to us here on the island, the Queen's Own Association sent 6 ball caps, which are inscribed with the regimental badge and A-Team on the back, and 6 T-shirts with a regimental crest on the front and A-Team on the back to the youngsters. Oh, and we now have pictures of the youngsters sort of on the first contact with Adrian Hovestad, pictured by, near the plaque with him. And then we have pictures of them more recently dressed in their A-team getup beside the monument, having cleaned it up. So it's kind of an interesting combination of youth and sacrifice and dedication, remembrance. There's a lot of angles to this story. But it does connect in such a way that we on the Queen's Own Association certainly appreciate the offer that this Dutch group, youth group, has made. It has appeared on Dutch YouTube celebrations or notices in Holland and is apparently quite a popular watched event now. And whether or not it's going to lead to any others taking on a similar challenge, I don't know. But these youngsters seem very sincere about it. And, of course, it makes great press from our point of view during the lead-up to the centennial year. Because there will be a tour, in all probability, next fall, by a veterans group from the Queen's Own Association, which will include a visit to Doorn and the A-team, in order to express more personally the appreciation of what they're doing. So I'm booking in for that tour if it takes place, and I'm sure that I know a few others who would too. So in addition to just touring the battlefields, we can thank some of the youngsters who are looking after
what a wonderful connection to our fall. To make,
So it's a nice feature of the year that's building for us here now. And I expect they're sincere in their promises, and I'll provide you with some pictures of the team in action.
That would be wonderful. Yeah. I can look them up on YouTube as well and see.
Yes, you probably could. I had an address for it, but I can't. I don't use it, so I'm sorry. I can't give it to you offhand. But I think I could probably pull it up somewhere.
Has the preservation of monuments that you're familiar with been a problem or an issue in any other instance?
No, I don't think so. They are literally everywhere in Europe, including the beach that, in case of our regiment, the beach that was taken on the landing at D-Day, right through to the Rhine. When the campaign was in its final days. There weren't many Victoria Crosses awarded in the Second World War, but one of them was awarded to Sergeant Aubrey Cousins, who was the platoon sergeant for an action at Mons. And he was awarded the cross and is a source of pride for us. There is a bridge named after him somewhere over there, but there's also a plaque commemorating the event, and I think there's a bridge named after him in Ontario as well. He was from a small place, I think Northern Ontario originally, but he was one of the few. I think there was only 12 or 13 Victoria Crosses in the Second World War, and he was one of those awarded. Of course, he was killed in the action for which he was recognized, which is a shame. There are monuments everywhere, and most of those have been put up at regimental expense. In fact, I think they all have. Obviously, outside of regimental monuments or commemorations, there is the grave sites for many of the Canadian fallen. And needless to say, there's a lot of riflemen in those campaigns, spread from Normandy right through to the Hawkwall.
Now, the Queen's Own has a tradition of medallions to commemorate the war
dead. We do. We had a special little medal crafted for the 50th anniversary in 1910, and it had a ribbon with a small silver medal on the bottom of it. In 1960, the 100th was commemorated by a bronze, heavy, well-engraved, well-conceived medallion, which was sort of toonie size, so you could carry it quite easily, and I can show you one of them if you're interested. This one that's being struck for the 150th anniversary is a beautiful medallion, but it's large. It is, and again, quite thick. It is kind of in the modern look of things that have been crafted for the armed forces in other ways, for other purposes, and for the Americans are great users of medallions, but they are not the kind that you could carry in your pocket, which the 100th was, and became sort of an easily portable thing. This medallion will be a little heavy for pants pockets or purses, I think, but nonetheless, it bears a colored replica of the regimental badge, a five-colored replica, and much like you'll see on some of the material, the obverse is a picture of Her Royal Highness, Princess Alexandra. So she's saluted for 50 years of service to Canada and to the regiment. The regiment itself is saluted on the other side of the coin with, or the medallion, with 150 years of service to Canada. So it's a different medallion than we've been used to, but it's one which was, when the first images of it came out, it was very popular among people today. And I suspect it's going to be one of those keepsakes that will be carefully guarded, because there's no way this is going to be reproduced. And the numbers are being established now as to how many we'll make, because there are ways to get the medallion, and that is, you must be a member of the National Association in current good standing as of January 2010. The other way is to make a donation to the trust, the limit of which is negotiable, but that's the only way you'll get a medallion. So they're going to be fairly precious as time goes on. Certainly the 100th ones were, and I was fortunate enough to get a 50th, a 100th, and I think I'll get one of these. So I'll have the string of the three major commemoration medallions. What I'm going to do with them, I'm not quite sure, but I'm sure we'll find a cause when I no longer will be carrying it. Yeah, it's a popular way of commemoration. And,
is it a tradition in other regiments as well?
Yep. Many of them have their own coins, their own way of commemorating special events. The Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry will be commemorating its 100th anniversary of formation in 2014. And I'm sure that they're working on something similar. I wouldn't say it would be the same style or the same weight or the same size, but there will be something that all serving ranks will get at that particular time, along with, in our case, members of the association in good standing.
I wonder if we could talk now about the Korean veterans and the Wall of Remembrance.
That is a particularly... I guess, memorable event in my mind, because Korea had often been referred to as the Forgotten War, and there was no national commemoration project anywhere. And it's interesting how it grew out of a visit to Korea by two men who were veterans, who were asked by the relatives of Korean casualties who had died during the conflict to take a picture of the headstone at the grave in Busan of their loved one. And there are about 360 or 70 buried in Busan in clearly distinguishable Canadian plots. They are commemorated by a bronze marker, heavy bronze marker, which contains their regimental number, their name, their regiment, and the date of death, and a regimental in a cipher or insignia on it. So they're quite handsome. So the pictures were taken of a few of these, brought back home, and then because of the interest shown, they said, well, maybe they, being a Korea Veterans branch or unit, said, well, maybe we should go over and take a picture of all of them and bring them back, and we'll use it as a traveling display when we can move it around the country for special events connected with the association or the war. Well, that didn't quite happen, but what did happen between the first pictures and this other proposal, which didn't come off, was the idea that maybe we should have replicas of those headstones displayed in Canada. And because it got started off as almost a personal endeavor with one small branch of the association, the site was negotiated to be Brampton, Ontario. And it was placed in a cemetery because we could arrange for perpetual care and perpetual supervision on a site like that, probably easier, and certainly it turned out to be the case, easier than getting into government negotiations at the federal level, trying to get a site within Ottawa to place this. And one of the early proposals was to place it in Brampton. That was not terribly popular because of the location as opposed to Ottawa. But time went on, and the sponsors of the project eventually gave it up and said, no, we're going to stay in Brampton. We're not going to go into prolonged negotiations because we'll never get it done. So I was recruited. I was a member of the unit and was aware of the photographic project, but was sort of brought in after this memorial idea in a memorial garden gun launched, because we had not sought tax status, and to ask people to deposit money on a Legion bar and quarters and nickels and dimes, that was not going to get us very far towards the construction of this thing. It had gone along so far as to have a design in mind and what area would be occupied. And in the end, we had a memorial wall, which is a very attractive wall, with 516 individual nameplates containing the same information as on the markers in Busan. So this wall is quite a long wall, and it's sort of four rows high, and it contains the names in alphabetical order of the 516. I visited it about 2 weeks ago when I was in Toronto, and it's maintained very well. Things look great. The fall foliage had just fallen off, and the picture that you and I have in front of us shows a beautiful spread of red leaves at the back, and you can see from the changing of leaves in the fall, the trees have started to change, but these decorative bushes that are behind the wall, which show vivid red in the fall, contrasted by white flowers that have been placed on the top, give this a beautiful appeal, I think, from a photographic perspective.
Especially with a nice and blue sky as the backdrop that day.
Yeah, it is. It's gorgeous. That's changed a little bit because the property behind here has developed into something else. And they're, we sort of feel hedged in. You can see the boundary fence there. But just beyond that boundary fence, there's a larger building now under construction there, which I didn't know about. But obviously somebody else owns the land, and it's there. Now, in addition to the names that are on the wall for people killed during the war, there is a series of plots which run along the roadway along there, which were available for purchase by Korea veterans who wanted to rest there when they passed away. And all of the spaces have been sold to a combination not only of Korea veterans of Canadian origin, but Korea veterans of Korean origin. There is a very large association of Korean communities in the Toronto area, and they took up whatever space was not taken up by Canadians initially. And I looked at the graves, the markers the other day, and in most cases there's one of a couple that are commemorated now. there is couples' names like Joe and Mary Smith. And on the bottom, under Joe's name, it'll be born sometime, died. And on Mary's, it'll be born some date and died. The died parts, in most cases, are not yet filled in for one of the couples.
Okay.
For one couple, there's a wife or a husband missing or dead now, so that date is complete. But there's a surprising number of them have a blank spot for the demise of the other person. But it's a gorgeous site, and it was opened in 1997. And every year on the 27th of July, which is the ceasefire, there is a ceremony held there by the Korea veterans, mostly in the southern and southwestern Ontario area. It is also visited by schools nearby. There's a very large public school not far from it. It's always there, and there are others from the Brampton area who occasionally come in to participate in Remembrance Day services, as well as the celebration of the ceasefire. So, from a point of view of a private endeavor, this has turned out to be very well, very good. But what's happened is that there was a group, particularly propelled by one man, and I won't name him, but who had connections to Korea in various ways that most of us did not. And he wanted to have a different monument for remembrance. So he has called, this is called, the wall is called the Korea Veterans National Association Wall of Remembrance. The other monument that this fellow started to work on was called Monument to the Canadian Fallen. And he had two statues made. One, which was based and is placed in Busan Cemetery, with all the names of the Canadian fallen around the bottom of it. And it shows a Canadian soldier with a girl in one arm and a young man standing beside him with his fellow's arm on his shoulder. And he had two made, one of which stayed in Busan, as I mentioned. The other was brought back to Windsor, Ontario, and was placed there while negotiations went on with federal government people to get this statue, the one, this extra one, so to speak, placed in Ottawa. After whatever negotiations took place, it became sort of public knowledge that this was going to be placed there. And it was commemorated in 2003 by placement there and the attendance of the Governor General, Prime Minister Chrétien, Sheila Copps, who was, I think, the Minister of Foreign Affairs at that time, and I and a friend of mine, Charlie Belzeal, were on the platform. I was speaking for the veterans in English, and he was speaking for the veterans in French. So we participated in that ceremony and had some involvement with the kind of arrangements that were suitable for that particular location by way of advising the committee that was working on this. And it turned out to be a very nice event. A lot of Korea veterans came to join the celebration. And one of the interesting local factors is there was a Colonel Jim Stone, who commanded the 2nd Battalion of PPCLI, who were the first Canadian troops into Korea, other than the Navy, who were sailing the seas around Korea when war broke out there in June of 1950. But Jim Stone took his battalion, the 2nd Battalion of the Patricias, to Korea in December of 1950. Jim was a resident in the Broadmead Lodge here, Carolyn, at the time this dedication took place in 2003. I was asked, because I knew him, to approach him and see if he would be the honorary parade marshal for this event taking place in Ottawa. So I approached him and said, would you agree to be named the honorary parade marshal? Actually, the parade marshal. And Jim sort of lit up and was about to say yes when his caregiver said, oh, no, he can't go. He can't go from here to Ottawa to do that. And I said at the time, we're really not asking him to do that. What we're doing is asking him to lend his name to the event because he is so well known among Korea veterans. And Jim said, I'd be happy to be the parade marshal. When I brought him the program, he looked at it and he said, you know, Herb, this was a draft program and it was in its infancy. He said, you know, Herb, Marshall is spelt with one L, and they're spelling it with two L's. You got to correct that. So he was 90, 93 or 94, very sharp and very proud of the fact that we were going to be carrying his Jeep pennant in that parade by somebody who had actually driven him in Korea. So Jim has passed on, but our last salute to him was to name him the parade marshal, properly spelled in the end, and have him watch the ceremony in on his television in Victoria here. Very popular guy, a very good commander, and certainly worthy of the honor of being the parade marshal, despite not being able to get there.
Right, very nice.
It's a nice story, and there are things like that about each of these monuments which have their own special appeal to people. Having participated in both, I'm proud that they were done. But again, they were done with no public money. There may have been a little bit of public support. For example, in the wall dedication, in which I was the master of ceremonies and the conceiver of the program, we got the Queen's Own Rifles to come and be the orchestra, if we could put it that way. They were the background music for the hymns and in fact the Last Post. Their buglers blew Last Post and Remembrance. We had a pipe band from the Peel Regiment that marched the group from its assembly area up to its position in front of this stand. But the Queen's Own were involved in that, and they had been involved in the Korean conflict at the end as the troop supervisory group. So there's a connection through all of this, through various regimental connections, which sometimes are difficult to explain, but from my point of view are very meaningful as to the input that and the contribution that's been made by that regiment over the years. Just for your information, I've included a pamphlet here, and there is the conceiver of this project, William Allen. And that was me on a visit to Korea, looking at the grave markers. And, of course, the grave markers now here, where are they, are very similar. And to compare Pusan with these, you'll find that they contain the same information throughout the whole of the wall. I think there's another picture here which shows the actual, there's the actual Busan markers.
Now the Korea veterans are also commemorated in some of the older monuments that we have across the country as well. They're often added to the World War I monuments, is that correct?
Oh, yes. In terms of cenotaphs or memorial crosses, a plaque commemorating the Korean War, 1950 to 1953. It says Korea, 1950 to 53. Those are a standard issue which was arranged and organized and paid for by units individually and by the National Association. So we've tried to maintain a uniformity throughout by using that same plaque. And I participated in the placement of one here at the Oak Bay Cenotaph. For a while, the Oak Bay Cenotaph only commemorated the Second World War. It was beautiful. It's beautiful. It's lovely. But it's having maintenance problems now. And to try and nail something on that, nail or affix it, let's put it that way, was going to be difficult. And the First World War was not commemorated here. The Merchant Navy was not commemorated here in Oak Bay. The peacekeepers were not commemorated, and the Korea vets were not commemorated. So to get around the problem of putting a lot of stuff on that wall, we had a meeting with city of village officials, and it agreed that we would put four stone markers down here with for a plaque to be fixed with each of them commemorating World War I, Merchant Navy, peacekeepers, and Korea. So those are in place, and they've been in place, I guess, for about 4 or 5 years now. And yes, I was involved in the discussions around what would be suitable there without changing the central monument. So these are placed at ground level, whereas to go to the Yolk Bay Memorial, you have to go up a flight of stairs to get there. And as time goes on, veterans are having more and more trouble going up those stairs. So it was felt that placed on the ground, not to disturb the kind of ambience that is there from the big monument, these four individual rocks, stones, would have a plaque affixed. And ours is that standard one.
And again, this was all done through either the National Association or the local groups to get this done.
We
across the country, because these are on
it's a national pattern.
Yeah.
And there were a stock of them at one time. We now, to put one somewhere, would have to have one individually made. But we have the pattern. And as was the case, we had to have one made for Oak Bay. But in the major memorials across the country, including Ottawa, there is usually a side that will say, example, it's Korea, 1952-53. It's in larger letters and a larger type than on the smaller ones. If the Legislative Assembly monument down in Victoria has got the standard one on it, as have a number of others around here, Esquimalt, for example, has got it. And I don't know about Sydney. I would think they probably have too. So I don't know whether that's taken us off track or not. But,
no, that's wonderful to know about that. And you had one other brochure with mountain peaks that were named.
Yeah.
Tell me about that and the monument associated with that.
Well, that's connected with a unit that's very dear to my heart, although I never was a member of it. I am their national patron. And that is the 1st Canadian Parachute Battalion. That was a very unique Canadian unit that served in the British 6th Airborne Division during the war. Their battle history is short but furious, I guess, is a way to describe it, in that they parachuted into Normandy just after midnight on the 6th of June, so we're among the very first people on the ground, if not the first people on the ground. Their C Company was sort of an advanced group of that battalion and went in just a little before the others, but they were all on the ground by daylight on D-Day, having been spread far and wide due to navigational problems, weather problems, and I suspect pilot problems. But they managed to take all of their D-Day objectives, which principally were to isolate the bridgehead from German interference, and it amounted to the blowing or capture and destruction of a lot of bridges over the River Orne. And that was to contain the Germans outside the bridgehead if they attempted to get in. And it was relatively successful, at least from the Canadian point of view, in that all the objectives were either taken or destroyed. That group also participated, that same unit, with British 6th Airborne, in the parachute assault across the Rhine Yeah, a few months later, in March of 1945. And that was in order to breach the Rhine and get into parts of Germany in which fairly rapid progress could be made in the pursuit of German forces or the isolation of others. And that was a daylight jump. And the commanding officer of the day was killed in that jump in that his parachute got caught in a tree and he was machine gunned by German defenders. But his second in command, who took command on the death of Colonel Nicklin, was Major Eady. And Eady was the fellow who took the battalion from the bridgehead up to Wismar in northern Germany to face the Russians at the Elbe in order to prevent the Russians coming further west at that point in the war. There was a rush to not only complete the war but to take as much of Germany as possible by both the Russians and by the other allies, naturally to gain influence over the German populace at that time and over the territory, the ground involved, which became in the end the barrier or the border between NATO forces in 45-50 in 50 and the Russian Communist bloc, the Soviet bloc. So the unit participated in two major airborne operations as part of 3rd British Parachute Brigade. And that was commanded by a man by the name of James Hill, who had a special fondness for the Canadians. And it was pretty obvious in later years what he felt of them or about them. I had the pleasure of being associated with him in a number of ways, in that we became the last two patrons of the Parachute Battalion Association. He died about 4 years ago, but in some of the recognition and the meetings and the reunions that took place on that peak area, he would always send greetings, and in one place, he really sort of says things that show him just how much he thought. And the monument that's described there is a monument in a place called Siffler Falls, which is a provincial park in Alberta, and it has four mountains in the background in what is called the Ex Calus, which is the motto of the battalion, from the clouds. And those peaks are named Rhine, Elbe, Ardennes, and Normandy. The battalion was the only Canadian unit to participate in the Ardennes block to stop the German winter offensive from recapturing much of the land that had been taken from them as a result of the bridgehead drive. But in James Hill's own words, I'm quoting now from a message that he sent on his wreath when this monument was dedicated in 2000. And it says in part, the Ex Calus Mountain and its four peaks, named after the four battle honors which I've just mentioned. These battle honors were all gained when the battalion was fighting as an integral part of 6th British Airborne and the 3rd Brigade. I quote from my message on my wreath sent for the occasion. To the glorious memory of the men of the 1st Canadian Parachute Battalion who fought for freedom in the Second World War, 1939-45. That's inscribed. The next is his own personal feelings, in which he says, may this loved and living group of mountains hold and treasure forever the memory, aspirations, and achievements of those young Canadian men who, willingly answering Canada's call to arms in 1939, fought and suffered and gave their lives for freedom in foreign lands, in foreign fields, far from home. Destiny called them to represent Canada in an honored brother and highly revered members of a great fighting fraternity, the British 6th Airborne Division, of which they formed an integral part. May we thank the Almighty once again for raising men to match their mountains in times of great global need and peril. The battalion paid the price. 500 of their original members set sail and were killed, wounded, the average age being 22 years. So that's in words that I couldn't use. A tribute to Canadians in what is now an annual celebration in the Rockies.
Wonderful to have a natural mountain.
And those are inscribed on that monument, yes. Those words. So it is an out-of-the-way place, and interestingly enough, there is a climbing party who goes up the 15 or 2,000 feet above the parking lot that these mountains' peaks are placed, and ashes of paratroopers are taken up and deposited on Normandy. Every year there are two or three or four containers of ashes taken up for sprinkling at the top of the mountain. And it's become almost a shrine in some ways, I guess, but a very meaningful part of our association and our history. So those pretty well summarize the kind of deeds that I've been involved in with regard to memorials. And while the government of Alberta gave us the land for the 1st Canadian Parachute Battalion, Cairn, it is in a public parking lot. There is a bridge across the North Saskatchewan River which takes you to the peaks, which has been named the Topham Bridge. And Topham is another Victoria Cross winner from the Second World War who survived but is now dead. He was a medical orderly with the 1st Canadian Parachute Battalion, and the battalion secured permission to name that bridge after him.